Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 123 of Registry Matters. Larry, do you have an interesting story today to tell me about how your car works? Oh, by the way, how are you tonight?
Oh, well, I'm not walking in a balanced fashion anymore.
Your tires are unbalanced?
No, the weight in my right pocket has changed dramatically since I left my house this morning.
Okay. Now I understand. What happened? Just give me the brief synopsis.
Well, I was doing my social distancing, and I did my first order by click list. And I went to the grocery store to pick up the order, which they bring to your car. And I didn't bother to scope it out. It wasn't the store next door to our office, but it was one that had only had to wait a week to get a slot, and I would have had to wait it longer at my store. And so I'm circling through the parking lot, and I did a cut across, and I apparently picked up a shroud of metal that gashed my tire. And so I ended up with a $330 repair bill for a replacement for two tires because it cut a long ways. It was not like just a nail puncture hole. They couldn't plug it. So my $70 grocery turned into a $400 trip when I added in the tires.
Wow. So that serves you right for ordering groceries online to go pick them up.
Well, it certainly did. I hope that I can get the weekly cost down a little bit lower than what this week's were.
That's definitely not an affordable grocery bill.
Well, hopefully. Well, how many times can you run over a piece of metal?
Infinite, I suppose. Just put the thing in front of your tire on the next rotation.
But that was. I check my tires routinely before I start every trip, and then I got an indicator on the way from the store to the office that I had low tire pressure. So I started circling the car trying to figure out which one was low, and I couldn't spot it by visual. But I put my ear close and I heard the hissing of the loss of air. So then I realized which one was leaking.
Well, I will introduce our guests for the evening. I don't know that we've had two guests on here at the same time, Larry. This is a first for Registry Matters to have two guests at the same time from opposite ends, the north and the south parts of the United States. Josh, you are well known on the podcast and certainly doing your own podcast, Josh Ho, doing Decarceration Nation and Twitter Extraordinaire. How are you tonight?
Yeah, pretty good. Thanks,
I'm
Andy.
So glad that you can join us. As you're always, always welcome and a very excellent addition when you are on. Larry, can you do me the favor and introduce King Alexander from Louisiana?
Okay. We have a person who has been with us occasionally, both on Narcelin Action and on Registry Matters, King Alexander, who is a supervising felony without parole attorney in the state of Louisiana, and it's Calcasieu Parish. Welcome, King, and this is really short notice. I happened to see the press release that we're going to talk about and as I was doing show prep today, and I said, well, I'm going to call him, and he actually answered the phone, and he actually said he would join, so thank you for coming.
Glad to be here.
Thank you very much, King. Larry, let me start this off. I have this, and everyone feel free to chime in with, I came across something that was a national poll. It said, today I learned a poll once included the question, have you ever been decapitated? 4% of the population said yes.
Well, that's
just a random thought.
That sounds about right. That's
margin about margin of error.
I have a feeling that they don't know what the word means, but I find that to be hysterical.
I'd say about.
It's possible that they regenerated.
I'd say about 4 out of every 100 people I pass are walking around headless. So I say that's about right.
Mike in chat says he has never been decapitated. I just wanted to start things off lightly with that one.
They could also be relatives of the headless person.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
That's 1 in 25. That's the exoneration rate from Louisiana's death row.
Oh no!
All right, Josh, you are here mainly for this late breaking news. I believe that a federal judge blocks Michigan from enforcing state's sex offender registry until COVID-19 crisis has ended. This is this first article is coming from the appeal. What's going on?
Yeah, so, you know, the same judge that just handled the case that everybody's familiar with, the Doe's, what's called Doe's 2 or the class action, Doe's v. Snyder, was asked to more or less weigh in on the problems of trying to enforce the registry at the time of COVID. It's the same. And so basically he did several things. One thing he did was delayed the time for the clock to start on his recent ruling on the Doe's class action until the crisis is over. But more importantly for people on the registry, he basically said that the registry can't be enforced from the beginning of the crisis until the end of the crisis. And he actually has a particular definition of when the crisis ends, which is when the state of emergency gets lifted and everyone gets notified, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to that, and this is what I thought was the most important part, he very explicitly said that prosecutors then can't go back and enforce strict liability failure to register cases after the fact. And so it gives everybody, in essence, a liberty, you know, amnesty until this crisis is over, because what we were experiencing was a lot of people not wanting to have to go into police stations to register at a time when they're not supposed to be, when they're supposed to be socially distant from people. And then we also had the problem where police stations were turning people away who were trying to register, which would have left them down the road potentially with having violated a strict liability law. And so it was, I think, a fairly good solution. And unfortunately, I doubt that that's the case in most states across the country, but it really should be given the situation.
Well, I do note that I think that I saw an article that Michigan had the state police had asked the local police already to stop their in-person. Did I read that correctly? I think it was Michigan where that the state police.
Yeah, they were going to stop the in-person registration for anyone who is before 2011. And that was going to happen relatively soon. But then there was some infighting about that, and it had been announced, so it was probably going to happen, but it wouldn't have covered everyone. This order covers everybody.
And okay.
So at least until the emergency lifts.
I find it so discombobulating to me, and I have trouble even understanding that these departments would even consider having in-person reporting taking place, because you would want to keep your officers safe even if you don't care anything about the people. And it's one of those things where you have an absolute defense. Well, you don't have an absolute. There's never such thing as absolute defense, but you certainly have a good affirmative defense, in my opinion, because if you're under health quarantine, and this is not one of the list of exceptions to the quarantine order that you're supposed to stay home. You know, the registry is not a grocery store. It's not a pharmacy. And you're not a tier one responder that's going out to a job. So it seems like to me you have a very good affirmative defense that you could not comply, because to do so would have been violating a directive. Therefore, I think that a case would go nowhere, even if a renegade prosecutor were to bring such a case.
That's a good thing we have a lawyer in the room, because, I mean, the way it was always explained to me, and I could clearly be wrong on this one, is that I remember literally sitting in my lawyer's office, and when I sat down when I first got arrested, I said, well, I have a whole bunch of affirmative defenses. And he looked at me and said, you don't really, those don't work so well because it's a strict liability law. And in the case of failure to register, most of those, as I understand it, are strict liability. And so you could have defenses till the, you know, as long as the day is, and maybe it will work. I don't know. But I think my understanding at least is legally you're still responsible to register. I could be totally wrong.
I think as you're diagnosing and describing a strict liability, there's a little misunderstanding. A strict liability offense is not what you describe. A strict liability is that you can commit the crime without knowing. An analogy would be like speeding. You could be driving down the road and be going 55 in a 35-mile zone, and you can say, officer, I didn't know, and it doesn't matter that you didn't know. The knowledge is not a requirement. But in more serious offenses, and all felony-level offenses, with exception of sexual offenses and a few drug offenses in the state of Florida, and I worked on a case in Florida, so I'm familiar with their strict liability, there doesn't have to be any knowledge or intent to break the law. You just simply, by the fact that you're not compliant, but you're on orders. It's not even the same analogy. You're on orders to stay home. And I would just love to do the closing argument if a prosecutor brought a case. And I would say, Your Honor, just ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if it's a jury trial, we had a situation where the person was complying with the governor's or the whatever authority issued the stay-at-home orders, and they could not go out without contaminating and risking public safety. And therefore, you should this person should be acquitted. And I don't think anybody's going to be convicted. But that doesn't mean that someone might not get arrested. And that's the fear.
I think you have a lot more faith in judges than I do.
King, what do you think? Do you think Larry or Josh is right?
Well, I would just add this. Strict liability is one of the subject matters that the federal courts who have looked hard at registration have in their crosshairs. Strict liability is supposed to be for really low-level type offenses, like a parking thing, and to apply it to very serious crimes where it doesn't matter, like lack of knowledge of the victim's age shall not be a defense. That's almost universally in the Louisiana sex laws that deal with that. But I remember in putting together what I've done for the CLEs that I teach on this, that in the federal cases where this has been litigated, strict liability is one of the subject matters that they look at. It is a due process issue. And so it is kind of a sliding scale, whether it's okay that you don't have notice that you're violating the law. It kind of depends on what's at stake with the law in question. I can tell you that my point there was that strict liability already was problematic when we didn't have this pandemic emergency. Now it's crazy to require in-person reporting is a whole other area that is questionable whether it meets reasonable basis test, you know, for legislation, and things that restrict liberty, you know, should be subject to a little bit more than just the reasonable basis test. But where I live, it's not uniform in Louisiana. A Jefferson Parish attorney recently chimed in to our listserv for the Louisiana criminal defense lawyers that because I asked, are they still requiring in-person reporting there? And one lawyer's client in Jefferson Parish, which is part of the greater New Orleans area, which is a hotspot, they said that they had been allowed to report remotely. Well, I've been told that here in Calcasieu Parish, which is the 14th district, Jefferson is the 24th, they're, in Calcasieu, they're still requiring in-person reporting. And they've got the most boneheaded people that they could possibly have over that, people that didn't work out on the detective squad.
Is boneheaded a legal term?
What a surprise. what a surprise, King. You know, I used to talk about that when the sheriff is responsible. Fortunately for us here in Bernalillo County, the sheriff doesn't run the jail. But in the majority of jurisdictions, they do. And the people that end up on jail duty are usually not people who say, Sheriff, I tell you, if you make me a deputy, I sure would love to work in the jailhouse. I mean, when you end up in the jailhouse, it's because you failed usually at most other assignments, and you're on some kind of punitive detail because you couldn't get your act together. Most people want to be on patrol or be on detectives. They want to be on court security. They're not interested in working in the jailhouse. So you don't have the cream of the crop of the sheriff's department working in jails, but you do have some good people. I always put that qualifier in there because people say that I'm stereotyping everyone, but the cream of the crop doesn't rise to work in the jail detention centers.
Well, I could say how it's done here in Calcasieu. They all start out in the jail. Everyone who works for the sheriff starts out in the jails. But if they're still there after 2 years, that means the cream didn't rise.
All righty.
Do you want to move on to the article for King there, Larry? Are we ready to go there?
I think he's ready to talk about his press release. In your case, King, your department filed filed some legal action, and my story says motion, and I just want to let you explain it. But your department has undertaken some action to try to free hundreds of people from custody. So tell us what you did.
Well, the original reporting on KPLC, which is the NBC affiliate here, it was by Teresa Schmidt, who's been there a long time. I know her. And when I saw the way she had originally phrased it, she said that we filed a lawsuit. And I texted her and I said, we didn't file a lawsuit. You know, it's a motion. Our clients are the defendants, you know, and they want a hearing on this. And she said, well, I'll fix it on the online version. But that's what we did. I have a copy of that. And then the district attorney's reaction, oh, it was just kind of typical. And I crafted a rebuttal to it. Let me just click on the article for a second to see what he said. And this is pretty typical of when he talks to the media. This John DeRosier, DeRosier. There's a lot of press about him. The Washington Post has written about him for different things. He's being challenged. This is an election year, and the prior elected district attorney, Rick Bryant, is running against him. The guy who handed it off to him in the first place is now trying to unseat him because it's just become ridiculous. And what he says in here, with it rubbed me the wrong way, he says, the public defender's office refuses to recognize the difference between those who have significant violent criminal histories and those who are currently charged with a nonviolent crime. Well, you know, let me just say, it's typical for him to start out his comments to the media by denigrating the defense function altogether. This time, he falsely accused the public defenders of, quote, refusing to recognize that inmates aren't all the same. Frankly, that's just ridiculous. He goes on to say that there needs to be analysis and adjudication. Well, of course, that's what we asked for. Sorting one inmate out from another is for the judges. We're advocates, and the district attorney, DeRosier, is an advocate. We filed a motion. He didn't. That's his prerogative, but he has no business saying we shouldn't have filed it. If he thinks it's frivolous, then let him ask for sanctions. Don't hold your breath on that. He'd rather just, you know, bash us in the media and unfairly. That's just, you know, I wouldn't be saying so much about it if he didn't do it every time. Now, here's the issue. The Louisiana Supreme Court issued emergency orders and guidelines for release of prisoners due to the coronavirus pandemic. Now, those orders and guidelines need to be enforced in Calcasieu Parish. Now, that would be done at all only after a hearing on the record in the light of day. If the DA doesn't want a motion filed, that way nothing happens on the light of day. Nothing really happens at all. But I mean, the sheriff is not, you know, if the sheriff has a dog in this fight, it is that he needs fewer people in his jail right now. He has not only a jail, but a sheriff's prison, where he has State Department of Corrections prisoners. It's sad when the only limitation on the overcrowding in our local jails is because the fire marshal has to say something. If the defense attorneys aren't filing motions, then they're not doing what they should do. And this needs to be done with uniformly across all the divisions of the court. There's no unity in the court here. You have a couple of judges that don't want to let anybody out for anything. They set million-plus-dollar bonds on every case of a certain type and so on. So what we've asked for is an en banc hearing. That way, if they grant this, all the judges would sit together in a single body. It would probably just convene by video from where each one of them happens to be. And they would all hear all the applications, and they would vote on each one. And what that does is you would have maybe more reasonable core or a majority among all the six districts that have adult felony cases going. And you would get more uniformity result across the board instead of some judges that go light on everybody and some that go heavy on anybody. There's no uniformity, and that's a problem. And it goes without saying that time is of the essence on this. Look at the mounting deaths next door to us in Allen Parish at the Federal Bureau of Prisons facility there. They were up to six dead in there as of this morning with the morning paper. Last time I looked, and there are many more inmates and employees sick with the COVID-19 coronavirus there. We're asking our judges for a prompt hearing before this disease gets into our jails, or it may already be there. I mean, they may not even be testing. We haven't heard anything. Now, they say they don't have any cases. Now, that's great. That means you don't have to fear them getting out and giving us the disease. But if you have it sweep through there and kill people, the level of care is notoriously low anyway, all the time. And
hey, King,
you
said a term that I've heard a legal podcast that I listened to use. Did you say en bac?
Well, it's French words. E N is the first one, and the second one is banc, B-A-N-C, bank, like in a panel. It's like a panel of judges. En banc means in the federal courts of appeal, for instance, we were in the Fifth Circuit. Sometimes litigants may ask for a hearing or a rehearing en banc, and that just means that all the judges or a quorum of the judges sit to hear the thing together instead of one judge. And in the courts of appeal, it's usually a panel of three, but an en banc is a much larger panel that cuts across all the different little.
Well, I was wondering if we can zero in. What did you ask for in your motions? Because we've gone into a lot of detail about the what the prosecution said, but what are you seeking succinctly? What are you asking to be done?
I'm ready to summarize this motion for you. It's just barely over two pages, and it's very much along the lines of what Josh was saying. And really, it goes to what the work that Louisiana Supreme Court has already done, because they categorized everybody into risk categories, and they made recommendations to the district judges that what they should do. It's just that here they haven't done it, or they don't have any unity among the judges. They're all doing different things. Basically, we've asked for an en banc so that we have the whole deliberative body, and there's more uniformity in the result across the district. Four categories of things: judicial release persons who are not a serious danger to the community; two, meaningful bond reductions, which have been scarce; three, setting of detainer bonds, that is allowing people to bond out on something that would normally hold them in jail if we weren't having a pandemic and you didn't have to have social distancing; and then the last fourth thing is to reconsider sentences of people who are very near the end of their sentences. If they're within 6 months of release, just go back, revisit that sentence, and see if it doesn't make sense to just cut that person loose and get them out of there.
Now,
and all this is just in line with what the top judges have already said. Go ahead.
Keena, so now we're still discussing jails, right? This is not the Louisiana Department of Corrections. We're talking about the local jails.
This is local jails, but you have people serving State Department of Corrections terms in these jails as well, and you have parish jail terms. So
okay.
It's all of the above.
Okay, so but it wouldn't do anything for the actual Department of Corrections for Angola and places like that. It wouldn't do anything for them. You'd have to be in a local jail, correct?
Right.
Okay, just point of clarification. So the corrections department is a whole different ball game in terms of that, because they're not doing anything.
It is a whole different thing, but yeah. If the judge who was the sentencing judge, who was in the division that sentenced someone to a Department of Corrections sentence, they are now authorized to revisit those sentences if they're within 6 months of completion. That's across the board. And so if they're here doing a DOC sentence, most of those people will have been sentenced by one of the judges in our district.
And so, like in Michigan, we had this situation where about a week and a half ago, where the governor put out an executive order on jails and did a lot of the things that are similar to what was in that that letter and a few other things. We've been waiting patiently for well over a week now for her to also put out her executive order about prisons that we've heard about, but it seems to be delayed in that, as we were saying earlier, in the politics of the thing. What we really like to see is what King just said a second ago. A lot of times we get caught up in these discussions about what kind of crime category people were committed in. In my opinion, if someone's a couple months away and they've done a 20-year sentence, who gives a damn if they get out in April or they get out in June? If you really are that worried about the 2 months, then, I think you've got the wrong priorities, and you should be trying to get out everybody who you can get out. That's either inevitably going to get out soon, which means the same risk of same public safety risk, or people who are a low public safety risk at the very least. We should get everybody who's a low public safety risk, people who are, in for everything from, nonviolent offenses, low-level offenses, personal use, drugs, and stuff like that, and then start working on a case-by-case basis to get as many of the people out as you can after that. That'd be my
opinion. Exactly. It's just the common sense stuff. Cut down the population in there. It's dangerously close, as you said. And I remember meeting you now, I want to say, Houston, when you mentioned Heaven Serve. This is a multifaceted approach that the Louisiana Supreme Court has fashioned, and you got some judges just refusing to play ball, and that's why we asked for en banc, so that a majority of judges might be able to outvote the outliers. And in some cases, this would be rehearings that we're asking for. But the Louisiana Supreme Court has already laid out exactly the type of people that they think should be removed from the jail populations, and we just have not been satisfied with the local action.
Do you have any idea, King, of what type of time? Because every day is important. I mean, when the courts are on conducting business at distance. Do you have any idea of what the timeline would be on the progression of these motions?
We asked for a hearing to be set as expeditiously as possible, but no later than Monday, April 6th. 2020, and that was Monday, and here we are on Saturday, and we're still waiting to hear if they're going to set this for hearing at all. If they denied it, I mean, they would have the right to the judges to decide whether they would grant an en banc hearing or not, but they haven't even told us whether they're going to do that, much less that they're going to give anybody any relief. It's really sad. I think the priorities are in the wrong place.
Well, the reason why I put the political article in there, because I don't want people to misunderstand this. It's easy to say, do the right thing. But when you get vilified for doing the right thing and it costs you your livelihood, judges in Louisiana are elected. Judges in Georgia and Florida, most of the Southeast are elected. I don't know about Michigan, Josh, you can tell us. But judges are elected. This is a dangerous step for these people to take. It's very risky. As far as the way they would be looking at it from a political standpoint.
They're safer in groups, and that's that, you know, the en banc is another thing that plays to that they wouldn't be alone. And that's why a panel is better than a single judge sometimes.
Well, and that's why I think it also helps for it not to be laid just at the feet of judges. And that's why, you know, I think it's important, for instance, like I said, our governor did a jails order that has made it very easy. Relatively easy for people to take these actions and have some political cover. It would be excellent if she used her emergency powers to do something about the prisons. We're very hopeful that that'll happen. I don't know if it will or not, but she did do the jails order, so we'll hope that she does the prisons order as well. Of course, part of the reason I think there's a delay is all of a sudden she's become one of the shortlist people for the vice presidential nomination. And so there's a lot of other considerations going on. It's kind of unfortunate.
Well, I'm envious that you have a federal judge, an Article III judge, who has jurisdiction over the overall situation, because that's how you happen to have an order that does away with the in-person reporting. We don't have uniformity across the state on that, and we don't have a judge who's litigating the overall registration scheme now, unfortunately, although we have hopes of doing that in the future. And Michigan certainly is a guiding light for every jurisdiction right now.
Yeah, it's certainly been interesting.
Well, for everyone to chime in if you have something to say. From the appeal, amid COVID-19 panic, Pennsylvania Republicans warn governor against taking executive action to release prisoners. As I understand it, this is the governor trying to release like 1,800 people. And, there's 40-something thousand people in prison in Pennsylvania. So this is just a drop in the bucket, a couple percentage points of people that could be released. Obviously, there's a whole bunch of people that would be excluded from this. I gotta think, Larry, I gotta think that prison is certainly not designed to keep people separated from each other by any stretch of the imagination. Releasing 1,800 people is not even any sort of significant number, but it's something. This is crazy.
Well, I only put this in here for one reason, and it's not to bash Republicans. It's an education. It just happens to be that it's the Republicans who wrote the letter, but it's to educate people about the politicization potential. When we talk about why don't they just do the right thing, and I was pretty adamant on a previous podcast, either last week or the week before, just do it. And I'm still saying, just do it. But this is an example of just doing it, what the consequence is going to be. These Republican lawmakers have already fired a shot over the warning bell to Governor Wolf in Pennsylvania. If you just do it, we are going to vilify you when the time and opportunity presents itself. And so it's mainly an educational opportunity for people to realize. The Republicans argue in their letter, this is the most absurd thing I've ever heard, that people in prison may actually be safer from the virus than those in the general community. The social isolation inherent in the operation of state correctional institution is an advantage shielding our offenders from community spread of COVID-19 occurring elsewhere. Now, that's a quote apparently from their letter. That is one of the most absurd things I've ever heard.
I hear you chomping at the bit, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, I've been more or less working on this nonstop for the last 3 weeks. So I don't know. I guess one thing I might add is just I want to read a little thing from this crazy radical journal called the New England Journal of Medicine.
No, that's not even peer reviewed. Just kidding.
Well,
it is.
Hold on. It is.
Yes, it is.
Okay, therefore, we believe that we need to prepare now by decarcerating or releasing as many people as possible, focusing in on those who are least likely to commit additional crimes, but also for the elderly and infirm, urging police and courts to immediately suspend arresting and sentencing people as much as possible for low-level crimes and misdemeanors, isolating and separating incarcerated people who are infected and those who are under investigation for possible infection from the general prison population. It goes on, but the point is, it's not just the crazy radicals. Like, I got in a big Twitter thing with a woman who worked as kind of the head person on Buttigieg's campaign yesterday, who sort of made the same point that the Republicans are making in that article. And it's just, I mean, first of all, I mean, let's just start at the tail end. Everyone's scared. Oh, my God, you're letting people out. Well, there's all kinds of jurisdictions all over the country who have been letting people out. Most county jails across the country have been decreasing incarceration and letting people out for weeks now. Jails are at their lowest rate in decades right now because of this. And as a result of that, a lot of police predicted there would be huge increases in crime. Well, there have been multiple stories that have come out in the last 2 weeks that suggest that not only are crime rates plummeting, but they're plummeting to historic lows, and that even in the major cities where decarceration is happening, that crime rates are plummeting. It's not entirely surprising, but that's the opposite of what people predicted. The truth is you're right, Andy, that there's a lot of people who are crowded in prisons. We both experienced this. And different prison levels have different levels of crowding. But you still want to try to ensure that the people who are most at risk get out. You need to test to make sure that they haven't already been infected. But if they're not infected, they need to, get them out. By getting any people out, it makes it more possible to socially distance inside the prison. So every person who gets out is a benefit to the people who are incarcerated. And so the more people that you... If you're going to keep people incarcerated, you want to let as many people out so there is more opportunity for social distancing. And on top of that, the more that COVID-19 spreads inside prisons and jails, and the whole idea that these prosecutors or whoever it is, the idea that somehow it's more safe in prison is just insane. I mean, I was in a pole barn with 160 people when I was incarcerated. And so we were in, 160 people in one big room. That's, there's no social distancing in that. That's not a place you're going to stay safe. What you don't want to do is have a whole bunch of people coming to work every day in a situation like that, where they can become infected and get taken it right out. I mean, even in a place like Michigan, where our Department of Correction has been extremely proactive, like from the very beginning, and extremely transparent in trying to deal with this, we have over 200 cases and over 7 deaths already. And, that's likely to increase by quite a bit before this is over. And just the idea that it's better to keep people in prison, just I've never heard anything as ridiculous as that. And that's why I started with the New England Journal of Medicine article, is because even epidemiologists agree that that's insane. And, you just really, it takes a special kind of person to make an argument like that, in my opinion.
It does indeed. And I would just add, that's very well said, Josh, but I would add one point that when we talk about releasing people from prison, this doesn't have to be a permanent release. Most people, when they're released from prison, do not vanish into thin air. These releases can be temporary. We could release even Weinstein temporarily because he's in great, I think he's already infected. If I remember, I think they've already announced that he's already infected. But they act as if that this is a get out of jail free card, never to return, no responsibility for your action. No, we furlough people all the time in the United States of America, and they come back at the end of the furlough period.
Michael Avenatti is out. He's out, but he's convicted too. But he has an obligation to report back when they say he should do it.
That's an excellent point, Larry. You know, there's also a lot of other powers that governors have under emergency powers and some of their other stuff that's happened as a result of COVID that they've been extended powers. And so you can do things like, you know, like in Michigan, we have to be, you know, everyone who's been incarcerated in a prison has to be in a secure facility. Well, the governor could theoretically suspend that secure facility requirement and allow people to be in an area that wasn't in the definition of a secure facility so that they could socially distance more. You know, you can move people to places that, gyms or whatever, and just have, you know, there's all kinds of things governors can do within that power. And then there's also, like Larry's saying, there's lots of things you can do. You can send people to parole and probation. You can put them on electronic monitoring. You can put them out for a while. You can, you know, there's all kinds of ways that this could be dealt with. And unfortunately, it is all bound up in the politics. We've seen in many states, there are governors who have really stepped up and started to try to do something about this. And in other states, we really have not seen much action, and that's basically caught up in the politics.
How I assume this would put a huge burden if we did that, you know, if we released that number of people, it would put a huge burden on the parole and probation departments too.
It doesn't have to, Andy. You don't have to. This is so simple that it's ridiculously simple. You can tell people you are furloughed until further notice. Call this number periodically to check in to see if the furlough's been lifted, and it's your responsibility to know when you're to report back to prison. You don't have to report to anybody.
Right. Right. And if you don't, you're getting a fugitive warrant or a bench warrant.
Well, let's move on to an article from ABC News. This is a Mississippi court won't undo a 12-year sentence for a jail phone. Larry, there was scant details here, but it seems that this person was picked up for a misdemeanor. So let's just say he was speeding and he ends up, I guess he makes it through like the initial kind of shakedown, whatever. And
we talked about this a few episodes back.
We did?
Yes.
I don't remember.
It's been on. Yeah. Well,
yeah, I think I was actually on that episode.
Yes. We talked about this.
It shows you what I pay attention to.
Well, this is where a guy, he got booked and they did not discover his phone. They did a sloppy search and he had a cell phone. And of course, it's hard for me to conceive that you would know that you weren't allowed to have a cell phone, but he had the phone. He's running around the jail. And maybe since people don't use regular phones anymore, he thought, well, this is cool, bro. So he runs out of electricity, he runs out of charge, and he asks the guard, he says, hey, bro, can I get some juice? And they prosecuted him for.
He clearly had not been incarcerated for long.
They prosecuted.
Long enough to run out of battery.
they prosecuted him for having the contraband at a correctional facility, and he has a prior offense, so it resulted in a mandatory sentence. And it's the harshness of the sentence that's at issue here, because he got 12 years for having the contraband. And the range of sentence was 3 to 15 years. He didn't get maxed out. He got what was within the zone, and that's within the sound discretion of the sentencing judge, and it's within the sound discretion of the state legislature to set penalty schemes. It's not for the courts to determine. This appeal is likely to fail. The cert petition is likely to be summarily dismissed with their famous one-line order. Now, that doesn't mean I don't support the appeal. I completely support the appeal. And as a matter of fact, I'm thinking about trying to contact them to see if there's anything we can do. But with the current makeup of the Supreme Court of the United States, I don't think they're going to want to second guess a state sentencing of an offender for a penalty scheme that they set in place, and it's within the sound discretion of a judge to sentence within the sentencing zone. I just don't see it happening.
Well, you're saying two things. One, that the state legislature has complete discretion on sentencing for an offense, and the other is that you don't see them granting cert. Now, it's rare for cert to be granted by the U.S. Supreme Court in any case, but so that's a different question. But as far as the power of legislators to establish any penalty they want to, there are constitutional limitations on that. It's the 8th and 14th Amendments, and we saw that enforced a year ago, February 20th, in Timms versus Indiana. Of course, they had to poke through the fact that it was a civil forfeiture to get to the excessive fines clause, but that was when they forfeited the guy's Range Rover, $40,000 Range Rover that he bought with inheritance money because he had a little bit of heroin in it that he might have been selling. The terms of imprisonment can be an excessive under the Eighth Amendment, which is provides against cruel and unusual punishments and excessive fines and that sort of thing. And you have proportionality doctrine, which has grown up out of the Eighth Amendment. This could possibly, I would actually make the effort if it were Louisiana conviction with a sentence like that. We have actually codified, or our legislature, I say codified, not codified, because it's code, not a cod, there is a state constitutional limitation depending on the case. If the sentence given, even though it would be within the statutory range, it may be constitutionally excessive. And I've seen them start sending down cases for resentencing. Even in my life without parole cases, if the judge says, well, there's only one sentence I can pose, it's a mandatory sentence, and so I don't have any choice, and I oppose it, they'll send it back to say, you shouldn't have said that you didn't have any choice because there's this constitutional escape clause that is now codified. I don't see that being granted a whole lot, but it's there, and they object to people saying that it doesn't exist.
Well, in theory, you're correct, but when the electric chair, it's not cruel and unusual punishment. It's rare that you're going to get a U.S. Supreme Court to think anything's cruel and unusual punishment. And there's just not a lot of guidance, the case law in recent decades that they found anything to be cruel and unusual or excessive. I hope he wins. I'm just an odds person looking at it. I don't see it as being a case that, I mean, they're likely to grant the one-line order saying, too bad, so sad, serve your 12 years.
Well, I'm just saying last year the U.S. Supreme Court did hear such a case and they ruled for the...
I'm familiar with that one, yeah. But it was a slightly different issue. But,
right.
But,
yeah. I mean, I obviously come at this from an entirely different direction because, I mean, I understand that he's likely to not have much of a remedy in the court, but I find all of these rules and laws on cell phone usage to be pretty ridiculous in my opinion. DOC should, just like they do with tablets and just like they do with a lot of stuff, give the people the ability to communicate just the way that the federal government does with emails in federal prison. And the argument that people usually make against that is that, people in prison will continue their criminal enterprises with people on the outside using the phone. And let me tell you, that happens now.
Right.
It happens using the regular phones and using the mail, and it's a little more difficult that way. And that's unfortunate, but it does happen. And, there's really not much difference. Criminal enterprises are going to criminal enterprise. And the question really becomes, how important is it for people to have communication in prison? Now, in the kind of work that I do, almost every bit of evidence we've gotten in these places like South Carolina when the riot happened, in the Lee riots, in Mississippi with Parchman, in, pretty much every time that we come up against really brutal prison conditions, Alabama, where the DOJ declared that it was had to go in and declare that it was unconstitutional, even though that obviously has to go to court to be determined. In all these places, the reason we know what happened in those places is because of cell phones. And that's the reason, the real reason why the DOCs fight this so hard is the last thing they want is transparency. And obviously on my side of the street, we want as much transparency as possible.
Crickets.
Yeah, the sentence is way out of line. It's just way out of line.
This sounds completely silly to me, is giving this guy 13 years for this, 12 years for this, 12 years.
Well, he was a repeat offender.
Yes.
Well, I mean, this is the classic debate about sentencing enhancements and habituals and stuff like that. You know, there's a guy in Michigan who is in prison for like 60 years, and everyone always says that he's in prison for pot, which is technically sort of correct. He was arrested for pot, but he also, when they went to his house after they arrested him, he had a previous felony, and they found a handgun in his house, and they found ammo in his house. And so the combination of his previous felony, the new felony, and the handgun and the ammo gave him a habitual. So he's actually in prison for the habitual offense, even though the actual instigating action was selling marijuana. And this happens all over the place. I mean, people think that whatever you got arrested for is all that your charge is, and that's just not the case.
Well, I'm not condoning the sentence, but I'm just telling you that in my assessment of where the court is and in the Supreme Court, it's unlikely they're going to grant the guy any relief, and he has no other remedy that I'm aware of other than possibly executive intervention. Now, I would certainly do that as well. I would apply for executive intervention, but when you apply for clemency, any type of sentence reduction, it's a long shot, particularly one that's got a potential for vilifying the executive, is that he's letting a career criminal go. He's committing the sentence of a career a criminal. But I'm all for him, so don't misunderstand my position.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. Well, let's move over to an article from the Marshall Project. Federal prison factories kept running as coronavirus spread. First off, I want to make a comment about this. I think it might be towards the end. Like, if you're going to be stuck in a dorm with a bunch of sick people, may as well be stuck making uniforms and whatnot. I don't frankly see that there would be a difference between the two until you start showing symptoms and perhaps getting sick and you need further medical attention. But whether they're in the dorm or go into work, doesn't seem like there's actually much difference, because it's not like they're going to be separated in the dorm. They're just going to be all piled on top of each other, like Josh was describing a minute ago.
Well, that was why I put the article in here, because I wanted to raise that question from people who have been in prison. If you were try to imagine that COVID-19 existed when you were in prison, and they ask you, do you want to be continuing to go to your job at the factory, or do you want to be sheltering in place here? Which would you choose? Because I don't even know how to begin to evaluate this.
From my experience, the beds, if you're in an open dorm, the beds, if you're a very broad-shouldered individual, you're not even going to be able to walk down between the bunks without turning sideways. And so, I mean, they're that close together. Maybe they're 3-ish feet apart. So you're stacked on top of it. That some places will even have three-story bunks. I mean, you're just stacked in there like sardines. It's literally insanity of how close everybody is together. You have zero, less than zero privacy.
I mean, obviously it changes a little bit depending on your security level. If you're a very high security, but the vast majority of prisoners are in a low security situation. They're going to be warehouse, like what Andy and I have talked about. You know, if you're in a high security level, you're probably going to be in a two-person cell, but there's very few people relative to the, you know, most people are in the 160 in the big warehouse situation that we were talking about. And so, yeah, I mean, when you're in a warehouse situation, you know, I mean, being at work is probably much better than being in your, you know, especially depending on what your job is. I mean, so a lot of people's job is to work in the unit. So correct. There's not really necessarily a break there.
Well, this was specific about Unicor. So I guess we should commend the Bureau of Prisons for keeping Unicor up and running, because actually they're keeping people possibly safer.
Perhaps, but they're not being, the guards are coming into work. I think this is the one that said it, that they're coming into work with face masks and gloves and whatnot. And the workers are still, you know, unprotected, so to speak.
We can't afford to be buying those ridiculously expensive masks for people in prison, for God's sakes.
We have real people that need them, right?
Well, luckily we have people like Reform and Meek Mill who've been buying tons of masks for people in prison.
Well, I just agree that space is what they need. Louisiana's got the highest incarceration rate in the world because it's a first again among the states in the United States. Woo-hoo! It's first in the world.
More exceptional, really, America. Yeah.
Very briefly, after some parole reforms and time counting reforms that we had in 2017, Louisiana dipped down below to third, actually. Oklahoma became first and Mississippi second. We were right behind, but now we're back on top. You know, it didn't get a lot of press. And so it's no exception here. You know, Louisiana encourages sheriffs to build sheriff's prisons rather than allocating funds centrally to build state prisons as other places do. And this was the subject of a very good Cynthia Chang. Well, she's at the LA Times, last I knew, but when she was at the New Orleans Times-Picayune, she did an 8-part series on that called Louisiana Incarcerated. And I was curious about what the reasons why we have so much incarceration. And it's all the kind of social demographic reasons and so on, and regional attitudes toward law enforcement and so on. But their ultimate conclusion was that it was the sheriff's prisons. You have the same people who have, it's like in the old days you had a cowboy who had a horse and a lasso and a corral and a yeehaw round him up. You have the same thing now, only it's the deputies and the handcuffs and the units, and the same people who are making arrests on the street are also the sheriff who is trying to meet the bond indebtedness that he incurred to build this thing in the first place. And some of them are getting in trouble with that, and the legislature's getting tired of hearing about it, really. Not that much sympathy in the legislature anymore. That's interesting. So they've got this perverse incentive to fill their beds, and if they can keep them filled at the state rate, well, that's the highest money they get is the federal rate. There's a different bed rate for federal, and there's one for state, and then the parish is below that, and the city is the lowest. So once someone is actually sentenced, then that's the last time the local sheriff wants to see him get away, because now they're getting a higher rate for that bed because they've got a DOC sentence.
Let me throw this out there. There's a sentence in there that says it's a factory. Social distancing is almost impossible in there as well. It's no different than inmates working on the rec yard or the dining hall. The rec yard, in my experience, is where you could at least find some level of solitude, that you could go find a corner on the fence or something like that. You could find a place to be, quote unquote, alone.
So, absolutely. You know, what's their excuse for not giving them any PPE?
Well, like Larry just said, we're not going to spend, I mean, we can't get it for the people that are on the front line working. We're not going to get it to the quote-unquote civilians. We're certainly not going to send it into prisons.
Well, I mean, to be fair, hold on for a second. The feds have been, there have been, at least I know for a fact at FCI Elkton, the people there did have masks at the very least. The incarcerated people did have masks. So I don't think it's universal that they don't have at least masks.
I bet you everyone's running around with a towel wrapped around their head.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, they'll do. I mean, one thing we do know is that, you know, people will come up with solutions on their own in prison. Yeah. That's
which actually, Larry, somebody emailed in, he may have copied you on it, that I think there's something in the Georgia code that says that, and I totally didn't understand it, but you can't wear a mask if you have some kind of conviction.
I think that was in Louisiana, that's a code that you can't. But again, if the health authorities are telling you cover your face when you're out in public, I would love to be on the defense end of one of those charges. I hope that no prosecutor would bring one. But if they did, I would like to bring in a copy of the order and say, well, or the recommendation, because it's not an order in most places yet. But I'd like to say, well, you know, what do you want? These people are doing what they're being asked to do by governmental officials.
You're putting them in an impossible choice. I forget what the expression is, but you know, you're being faced with, okay, I can keep my face uncovered and die, or I can not comply and go to jail.
Well, you wouldn't even want to cast it that way. You'd say, I'm trying to protect the public, because they claim that it does more protection for the others than it does for you.
Sure.
So you would not want a sex offender out recklessly jeopardizing the public health. But like I said, I would, if one of those cases ever comes here, I will sign up pro bono to help with the defense team on that, because I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
I think you were looking for Hobbesian choice.
So Hobson's choice. Yep. Hobson's choice.
Yep.
Okay. Hobbesy. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Larry, you put in another article from the appeal. Reports from inside Angola prison paints a troubling picture as coronavirus grips Louisiana. Louisiana, this is your neck of the woods there, King.
We don't have to spend a lot of time. It's just that this prison is totally out of control in terms of what they're doing in every regard. Angola is a recipe to outdo New Mexico in the 1980 riot. That's how bad it is in Angola.
And back to the thing that Josh was bringing up about the transparency side of things, I really think that there should be some way to protect the integrity, the security of the prison, but there has to be some sort of independent auditing that protects the human beings that are still in there. And I know that Americans generally don't think of people that are inside the walls as human beings, but they probably still are considered human beings by most standards. And they should be protected from all of the abusive treatment, including the over-the-top that the coronavirus is.
Yeah, FAM Foundation, and this is something I suggested several years ago, but they've been suggesting that, that there's independent, people who work in the prisons who are independent of the DOC, and I've always thought that was a pretty good idea, that there should be almost like an ombuds that, not just one, but a system of people who go in and are there throughout the day and the night to, kind of walk through. There are lots of ways that you could handle it. I personally, when I was in prison, I wanted more cameras because cameras were our friends. It was a lot of trouble for anyone to have to try to block the camera or stop the camera or whatever. But I just think the more transparency, the better, when you're in a place where some people have absolute power and a dark corridor can really mean death. And in the case of COVID-19, transparency is really important because, you really want to know what the situation people are facing is. And, when we, like I said, in Michigan, we have over 200 cases in prisons right now of people who've tested positive in about 5 or 6 facilities. I can only imagine what it's like in facilities like, in a lot of the southern states like Angola or South Carolina or Mississippi, where we had 28 deaths since December in Mississippi prisons prior to COVID breaking out. So these are some pretty just dire. Florida is another great example of places where, just some really dire conditions and really terrible place for a pandemic to happen. And I suspect, a lot of people are really suffering as a result.
Always good news. Larry, over at NBC News, Kentucky man released from prison by ex-governor Matt Bevin, arrested on federal child porn charges. My only question to cover on this particular thing, isn't it double jeopardy if someone gets charged twice for the same crime?
Well, if the same entity charges them, yes. If they're charged by a different sovereign, no. It would only be double jeopardy if that sovereign had a law that says that if the same conduct is prosecuted by a separate sovereign, we won't allow it to be prosecuted. But as far as constitutionally, it's not deficient to prosecute someone for the same conduct as long as it's a separate sovereign who's prosecuting them. And I know King's chomping at the bit to clarify my answer.
there are, double jeopardy isn't as broad as I wish it were. A lot of really similar laws have different elements, and the jurisprudence, at least in Louisiana, is that if it has different elements, then it's not double jeopardy to charge them with this other thing. We saw that in the police riots where Rodney King got beat up. Remember the police in Simi Valley, where the feds went after him after they were acquitted in the state court system, and people thought, why isn't that? Why isn't that double jeopardy? And the reason was because it was a different offense. It was a federal civil rights offense, which is how they took jurisdiction. But I agree that that kind of thing is subject to abuse. I wish it were, there were more respect for constitutional protections for individuals.
So this guy is he benefited from Bevin's generosity after he lost the election, but he was too high profile and he generated too much attention, and the feds he came on their radar. They decided to bring charges, and it's unfortunate, but from a constitutional perspective, I don't see him having any remedy. I mean, he could certainly reach out to President Trump and he could take care of it because he has the power.
That's an interesting point.
Somehow, yeah, I haven't seen him pardon that anybody happen. For that yet, you know, but I don't know. I was surprised that he pardoned Arpaio before they could even do anything to him.
Well, I was being a little tongue-in-cheek.
Can I clarify something?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to make sure I understand something since we got multiple lawyers here. In this case, and I may be totally wrong about this, but if I understand correctly, they're charging him. So say there were like 10 different things they could have charged him for in the original incident, the originating incident, and they charged him for a set of them, and then he got pardoned for those sets. And I think, as I understood it, they're now charging him for the other set from that same period. And so even in the case where it was the same sovereign, it wouldn't be the same crime, right?
I'm confused with your question, but in this case it's a different sovereign. It's the feds come in, but so try to succinctly, because I didn't quite get King. Did you understand what he was asking?
Not completely. I think it's because okay. I don't really know the facts. I've been kind of looking. I'm scanning this NACDL aggregate to see if I could find the link to the article that you're talking about.
Is easy to explain. So say I committed a bank robbery. And you could charge me with robbing the bank. You can charge me with having a deadly weapon. You can charge me with threatening people with a deadly weapon. And you choose to just charge me with robbing the bank. And then I get pardoned for robbing the bank. And then the prosecutor, because we'll say there's no statute of limitation or whatever, decides to charge me for the other behavior that wasn't pardoned. I think that's what happened here.
That is really weird, because I can tell you that in even in Louisiana, that if they charge you with one thing out of a set of circumstances, and if you plead guilty to it, you have double jeopardy protection. Was this person pardoned before he was convicted?
Well, no, he wasn't pardoned at all. He had
Arpaio
was, you know. Okay, go ahead.
That's not what I was saying. I was saying that he was pardoned on a crime, and then they charged him with other elements of the set of crimes that could have been charged but weren't.
I know, but what the extra fact that I was looking for was, he convicted before he was pardoned?
Yes.
Because I don't.
Yeah.
Well,
he was
well
in
then,
prison
to,
for, yeah.
Then to me, double jeopardy should apply. I don't know.
It doesn't apply because it went. The feds decided to charge him. They had not previously charged him for the conduct.
Okay, see, that's the thing. It's the whole federal way. The federalism has turned into a gotcha, and that's how they got those Simi Valley police.
Yeah, the feds.
Well, and you know, yeah.
Well, like I say, he was too high profile, and he came on the feds' radar, and they decided, well, if Bevin's going to let him go on time served. He didn't pardon him. He commuted him. If Bevin's going to let him go on his state, that's nice. But we're going to come and use our sovereign powers, and we're going to prosecute him for the federal crime, which was the exact same conduct. And they can do that.
Yeah, and that's what happened with those police in California.
Now, my problem with this story wasn't necessarily any of that. It was the way that a lot of the news media reported it, because they tried to make it sound like, you know, after Bevin had pardoned him, that he had committed a new crime and was getting arrested for it, which is not accurate. He was being charged again for the same crime set from, I think it was, what was it? What was the year, 2014 or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, several
like
years
that.
Back. Yes. And that's the unfortunate reality of the press seldom gets their reporting right. It's unfortunate, but there's too often sloppy work done, and it's reality of the business. Yeah,
but it's really unfortunate in this instance, because we're at a time right now where we're pushing across the country for people to increase commutations and increase pardons. And so in these instances, when the press tries to make previous pardons and commutations look bad by suggesting that they led to recidivism when actually they didn't, that can be really damaging to the move to try to push for more commutations, for instance, because of COVID.
I agree with you, Josh. I agree with you completely. I wish I had more of a solution for the press, but unfortunately, in a capitalist system, there is no solution unless you want more governmental intervention.
Hang on, let me ask Mike in chat if he would like more governmental intervention. That's an inside joke. He says,
well, I think the other alternative is for people to, you know, essentially vote with their pocketbook for which press sources they think are most reliable. You know, I mean, we do have some influence on the press because we're the people who purchase their product.
But no one knows that this was an inaccurate story, and that press outlet is not going to tell. I mean, I would welcome if you could reach out to them and say, you people got it all wrong. But they're not likely to go back and say, whoops, we got this all wrong, and the public that saw this, as far as they're concerned, the guy committed another offense.
Yeah, but there's hundreds of examples.
Absolutely. They do this all the time. They ruin people's lives all the time. No.
What I'm saying is there's hundreds of examples of times where we have raised tackles and gotten people educated about what the issues were. I mean, there was that time fairly recently. I've forgotten the nature of the story. I think it was one of those Halloween panic stories where a whole bunch of people jumped on someone for making that case, and then a lot more people in the public got educated as a result. You know, I mean, by bringing attention to something, we do educate folks.
And I'm in agreement with that, but it's going to be a very slow process because most people, when they watch the news, or even if they use alternative means, they assume that what they're watching is true. If you went out and took a poll and said, you watched the evening news tonight, how much of that did you consider to be untrue and unreliable? Most people don't watch the news to say, well, I just got a bunch of unreliable information. I spent a half hour of my time watching junk. They consider it to be reliable information. That's why they tune in.
That is totally why they tune into that one. I happened to be behind somebody the other day, and they said CNN is fake news. And, I'm just baffled by those statements. Just baffled by it.
I fired off an email to the online editor of my local NBC affiliate, the same one that article was on. The heading is, why have trials? And I say, when KPLC can simply declare in a headline that a, quote, man beat his father to death, unquote, where so far he's only arrested for second-degree murder on suspicion of having done it, with some pretty incriminating details and so on. But really, they shouldn't say that. He beat his father to death. They know that jurors break the rules about looking at media on the cases that they sit on. In other Western countries, France, for example, which is a free speech country, that kind of conclusory reporting just isn't done. Lots of times they don't even name a person who is merely arrested or investigated for something because of the presumption of innocence. You know, our press enjoys First Amendment speech rights, but they've become very complacent about it when they do this kind of thing. They shouldn't do it. They should strictly adhere to it's alleged, or they say what a person was arrested for, but they shouldn't just declare in the headline that the man beat his father to death. It's a circumstantial case. There isn't any confession. So I do that, and they don't ever answer, you know, but I try.
King, since we're starting to run up against the clock, did you have a chance to review those two cases, the Supreme Court stuff? Because if you did, we're going to drop the other articles and talk about the death row case that's gotten attention, and then Sotomayor's about their individualized articulable suspicion, and that'll be enough. Okay.
Well, yeah, then, I read those and wrote some notes about them.
Well, then, Andy, unless you have a particular liking to the other articles, we can skip those, so we'll have enough time.
Perfect. Yeah, so the article then is The Statesman is a second death row inmate, second Texas death row case gets extra attention from the Supreme Court justice. And I'm not really sure what's going on here. So, King, fill us in.
Okay, well, that's the one, Halperin versus Davis, and Davis, yeah, is just, I guess, the warden, because it's a post-conviction relief. This is a death penalty case. The guy had the robbery that was fatal. These are some guys who had escaped from prison, and it's in Texas, where they actually do succeed at executing people, but this fellow's issues are not done. And I think that he will not be, Halpern will not be executed anytime soon while this plays out. This is the one about the comments by the judge with the Jewish fellow on Halpern on death row, right? This is not yes. the Fourth Amendment case. Okay, yeah. Well, it was just really crazy. I wrote, just wow, did they ever have the goods on this former judge, Vickers Cunningham. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, the thing ought to be read. It's far more egregious than I thought it was going to be until I got into it, the things that this guy said on a regular basis. And I guess that became known, and that's why he maybe isn't a judge anymore. The Supreme Court did not grant cert, and it was interesting that Justice Sotomayor didn't call what she wrote a dissent. She just called it a statement. And some of the things she said gave me possibly some comfort that this has some further channels to go through in the Texas state courts, and I think probably to the U.S. Supreme Court again. And again, I predict he won't be executed anytime soon. He's got some due process to be gone through, which is part of the reason why they denied certiorari. They look for things like that. And if something isn't all the way done, lots of times they just won't take it until it's in the right procedural posture. So, but I don't know if you wanted for your listeners to an example of some of the things this judge had said.
Well, we do, but when you said didn't,
we want to be careful.
We didn't grant cert. So just for the people who've not heard the term before, that means that a petition is filed wanting Supreme Court review, and it requires at least four justices to agree that it's worthy of their time, that there's some meritorious, and it doesn't, meritorious is not the right word. There's something compelling that they would like to hear that they grant cert. And then when you said it isn't ripe, try to expand on that, because what I interpreted from that was that they might be interested in it, but the case needed to further develop before the cert petition was premature. Did you interpret it that way?
Yeah, I interpreted that from what she said. I didn't read what the other judges said. They may not have said anything, but certiorari.
They didn't say anything other than cert denied.
Yeah, cert denied. What she said, she pointed out that there were some state court proceedings that had not been completed in which he would be able to address these issues in before the judges in which the thing was originally tried. I mean, this is the judge that tried the case in which the man was convicted and condemned to death. And it was just as racially egregious and sectarianly egregious as you could ever imagine. So the idea that it won't make any difference for this man at all, I'm not ready to say that they're there yet. And I don't think she says she's pointing out that this can be taken up. And that would be a reason for the Supreme Court not to do that. So first of all, they don't grant cert just to keep someone from being executed unfairly. And if it were only about that, then it might not matter what the judge. But how can they say that there wouldn't be prejudice in a proceeding in which these kinds of things were regularly done? These were things that were openly racially and sectarianly biased that he would say to political groups that he addressed and so on, and to his campaign teams and so on, the different things that he was in. But if the Supreme Court, they don't want to grant certiorari on cases that they ultimately wouldn't need to hear. And if there's something else that hasn't happened yet that may handle the case another way, then that's a reason for them not to grant cert. And they also look for reasons why they should grant cert. And I don't think on the list, well, they always have a catch-all that says, you know, to prevent a manifest injustice. But, you know, that would swallow up the rule. They're really looking for times when they have to weigh in on something in order to settle the law on a particular point that will have a wide impact on other cases. And it's hard for me to think that this case will be that. I don't think they'll get very many examples that go as far as what this guy did.
Well, this is just horrendous judicial bias. But yeah, you explained that very well, at least to me. It's something's not ripe. If there's a remedy below, the Supreme Court is not your option because you'd like a faster remedy.
Yeah, no, not at all. No, they're slow, slow, slow. And this guy, you know, he's playing the long game. I mean, I'd say he was, I think he was sentenced in 2003. The offense happened in 2000.
So, well, that was a point I put it in here for. So this is a case of judicial bias, and the Supreme Court may give us some guidance after he exhausts all of his state remedies in terms of what constitutes judicial bias, because people think mistakenly that if the judge gets angry with them, that's a bias. Well, it isn't necessarily a bias. Judges are humans, so they can be angry and frustrated with a person, but that doesn't translate to a bias. But this is pretty egregious bias with this judge had, or at least by all appearance.
And I will say it's not unusual for a death penalty case in particular to be before the U.S. Supreme Court repeatedly. And one of the last things that Sotomayor says, that if Mr. Halperin is unhappy with the way the Texas courts ultimately rule, then he can still bring his claims back to the United States Supreme Court.
So, fantastic. Josh, did you have anything to add on that one? I didn't mean to cut you out.
Oh, no. This seemed like more y'all's in y'all's sweet spot. So, well, then, y'all go do your legal thing there.
Yeah. Then let's move over to Reason.com with Sotomayor upbraids SCOTUS for a decision that destroys Fourth Amendment jurisprudence that requires individualized suspicion. The justice filed a lone dissent in Kansas versus Glover. I got nothing.
Hey,
this
what a
one
surprise,
is so far above my pay grade. I can't even like make it through the title without like, no, I got nothing.
It's a real surprise that the Supreme Court decided the Fourth Amendment doesn't cover something. Right. I'm truly shocked.
it's sad. If the Fourth Amendment, no Fourth Amendment violation to stop a vehicle because its registered owner is under suspension, regardless of who is actually driving the car when it is stopped by police. Therefore, a car registered to a suspended driver or any unlicensed driver is a no Fourth Amendment zone until the registered owner's license is restored. I almost have nothing to say. It's incomprehensible that mere registration to an unlicensed or suspended person is sufficient for a stop when they could easily look a little further to see, well, does that person behind the wheel look like the suspended person? You know, and the Supreme Court is, they don't care. They're not willing to impose a duty on the officer to try to get an idea whether the person driving is actually the one who's on the registration. It just blows a big unnecessary hole in the Fourth Amendment protection, in my view. And I'm shocked, not that that didn't prevail, but that what shocks me the most is that there's only one dissent. She's all by herself.
I was going to get there, Keeg.
I was going to ask about that.
This is supposed to be where the liberals, I would expect it, more dissents. So, I mean, I don't have a lot of hope for the conservative side to do the right thing.
Well, or something I do, like that. Because sometimes this kind of thing does matter to them.
I'm disappointed that the liberals didn't do anything on this either.
Yeah, yeah. Where was Ginsburg on this?
But
Larry, we covered an article last week.
The Fourth Amendment is so long and so deep, and it's been going on for so many years, that it's even eroded what's left of the liberals on the court. It's just, I mean, it's like a hollow shell, in my opinion.
But last week, Larry, we covered an article about Sotomayor. She's like, she threw her hands up saying, I'm not going to dissent on these cases anymore because no one's going to stick with me.
So
yeah, I remember that, and that's sad. You know, I was heartened when Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and Thomas, we got all of them in Timms versus Indiana on that excessive fines clause thing, which was in the criminal setting, even though the state of Indiana pretended it wasn't criminal, it was just a civil thing. They cut right through that. And so that was heartening, but then, you know, what we see happening now is not so heartening. We're still waiting for unanimous verdicts in Louisiana. It's been put off. That's Ramos versus Louisiana. It's been put off, but that could come down maybe on April the 29th, and if not then June 29th is the latest it could be. I preserve the issue, the constitutional issues, in every case that I have to take to trial, and so I kind of welcome this hiatus that we have in criminal jury trials right now, because I don't want any of my client anymore to be subjected to non-unanimous convictions.
So, well, I'm disheartened about the whole thing. I mean, I can see how they got to that decision if you want to be totally closed-minded, but I don't know what to say.
Yeah, okay. You know, if an officer can't really get a good look at the driver, but if they could, but I mean, there was just no effort at all to impose any duty on them to ascertain that before pulling over the car, that the person driving it is the registered owner. It's just an excuse to do something that they shouldn't be doing. And they did it for a completely different reason, most likely.
Go ahead, Andy. You're trying to fire a question in here.
I figured that we had beat this one to death already as well, and we can go to a voicemail message if anybody.
Let's do it.
Oh, wait! Before we get to that one, Larry, did you see that a link was posted about for the people that who's eligible for the $1,200? Can we cover that real quick?
Sure. As far as I understand, we will have a link in the show notes, but there's no prohibition on the direct payment on the $1,200 related to convictions for any type, including sexual offenses. And then there's supposed to be already launched, I think TurboTax is already launched, where you can register if you don't normally file a return, you can register your bank account. And I think the IRS, I'm not clear if they have launched or about to launch their website where you can go register your bank account information so you can get your stimulus payment faster.
And I've been watching for that. I don't think the federal one is up yet. I'm glad to know TurboTax has it. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Josh.
Just to be clear, the small business loan part, yes, however, does have requirements. Correct. There's two parts. There's one set of loans where if you've been convicted within 5 years or on parole and probation within 5 years, you're excluded. And the other section, I can't remember what the names of the different sections are. You have to register you have to essentially check the box if you've ever been convicted, and it's not entirely certain. They haven't explained if that means you're excluded or not. So in theory, on one side, it's a 5-year exclusion. On the other side, it could be for every single person.
Well,
this comes on the heels of a conversation that we had after the show last week with a very, very loyal listener who was, he hasn't earned enough income to file taxes in the last several years, and he was worried or wondering, and Larry being the know-it-all of all things, and I mean that in a very positive way, Larry, I don't mean that as a pejorative at all, that you were explaining to him that as far as we know, and here's the evidence to support it, that all of our people get the $1,200.
Well, now here's... Well,
I mean, there is an exclusion. There was, did they get rid of the... I think you get $600 if you didn't pay taxes.
Nope,
am I wrong about that, Larry?
No, you still get the $1,200. But now here's the hypothetical I'd like to propose. Social Security recipients are supposed to be included in this as well. Well, there are 2.3 million people incarcerated. If they're serving a sentence, they lose their right to Social Security until they're released, until you can take you can show Social Security that you didn't escape, that you were actually released, you're reinstated to your benefits. So hypothetically, since you're not receiving your Social Security benefits while you're in prison, they've been suspended, but yet you're entitled to this because Social Security is going to give them the information. If you receive benefits in the previous year, they're going to give them your 1099 and your banking information. Well, the people in prison, and I just shut the door, they won't now because of our millions of listeners, they're going to pick up on this, but will the people in prison get a direct deposit of $1,200 while they're suspended from receiving their Social Security benefits?
So there you go. So we all get it. Right? Well, you're talking about
it's a hypothetical. I don't know the answer to it. But say you were sentenced in October of 2019, so you would be receiving a Social Security 1099 statement that you received benefits through October. They have that system where they reward correctional facilities for reporting numbers, so everybody reports Social Security numbers dutifully, so they can get their intercept money for reporting the person who's incarcerated for under sentence. So you don't get it in pretrial detention on Social Security. You do lose it on SSI, but on Social Security. So you get your 1099. So Social Security turns your 1099 over to the IRS, say that you collected umpteen thousand dollars of Social Security benefits. Well, clearly, until they suspended you, you had a bank account and you're getting the 1099. So is the IRS going to also know that you're in prison? And is there any preclusion, even if they do know that you're in prison, from getting the $1,200? That's one that I just have to think about while we're doing the program.
You are always you are always looking for the how systems work and trying to see if there aren't, I don't want to say loopholes, but you just want to see how they stress test, I guess.
I cannot help myself.
I had not heard of any such disability, but it wouldn't surprise me, because usually, you know, the people who are most in need are always excluded. You know, like any reform that's enacted in Louisiana always excludes violent offenders and sex offenders, even those that are nonviolent, like the criminal knowledge.
Well, Social Security has already suppressed their monthly payment if they've been notified. So they've already suppressed their monthly payment. But if this legislation didn't create such a disability, it would seem like if they get the 1099 that says this person received benefits. Now, suppose they've been in prison for 8 years. Well, they won't be getting a 1099 because they've been suppressed for the 8 years. So they wouldn't be getting a 1099. And that's, I understand that that's how they're going to get the information for the benefits. But what about the people who drew benefits in 2019 and who are in prison now?
Yeah, I do not know the answer. One issue came to my mind as soon as they said they were going to do it this way. And I thought it was very slick on the part of the federal government, but they're messing up by being so slow to get to provide a way for people to give their routing number and their account numbers. It looks like TurboTax, the private sector, again, has beat them to it. But I have actually gone to great lengths. If I owed the IRS $1, I would go and buy a money order for $1 and send it by snail mail, because I did not want them to have my routing number and my account number. I knew an attorney who apparently he owed him a lot of money. It was a partner law firm where I worked, and he sent them a check for less than they thought he owed him, and they just sucked the rest of it right out of his account. So I haven't wanted them to have that information, but now they've created a situation where even holdouts like me would want them to have that information. I've been looking for a way to upload. I'm still waiting for them to create the portal.
So, well, I think it's very close, or it has been created, but certainly TurboTax has created the option. And as far as we know, everybody is going to get that unless they're a dependent. And then they'll get the person claiming as a dependent will get $600 for the dependent. But it's, otherwise, if you have a Social Security number that authorizes work, it's not just a student, something for ID purposes. If you're a citizen or a resident, you're going to get your $1,200.
Right. And even if you don't, you know, provide the means for direct deposit, then they eventually mail you a check.
Well, there you go. So that's in the show notes for anybody that might come across this. That anyway, you're getting your $1,200 almost assuredly.
Okay. Well, let's wrap this thing up. We're along as usual.
You got a
voicemail. I have to hear that.
Yes, and I haven't edited at all, but I listened to part of it and sounded okay, so I let it go. And here we go, and I can guarantee you it's not going to play the first time I do this. I can almost guarantee you. Nope, it is not. Give me 1 second to switch something. So, 1 second.
Well, I can do a shout.
You had one job.
I know, right? I know.
I know. I can do a shout out to two very fine people that listen to Registry Matters. After commenting about not having face masks last week, I have received a homemade face mask from a listener, and I've received two face masks from another listener.
Apparently, they love you because I didn't get a damn thing.
I appreciate very much the face mask, and I have been utilizing. I haven't utilized. I just got the ones in the mail today, but I got the homemade one. And I've been utilizing it already.
I found a 3M N95 among my tools. They totally astounded me. Did not expect it to be that, but there it was. So I don't have to use a red bandana anymore.
All right. So hopefully this will work this time. Here is a voicemail from Charles.
Hi, Andy and Larry. With the coronavirus, restricting everyone's movements and making life very difficult and putting people into the circumstance of virtual religious services, studying online and working remotely on the internet. Is there a very important argument to the authorities to say registrants need access to the internet without restrictions and reporting their identifiers, and that social media networks like Facebook should lift their restrictions against registrants, because this global pandemic has proven that life is not just in the physical realm, but also is on the online realm, and being on the internet is very important, especially in times like these.
I think that's a great question. Thank you, Charles.
I think I'm going to let the brighter people than me answer that one.
Here's where you can help, Larry. What's the name of the North Carolina case?
Packingham.
Packingham, yeah, that's it. Packingham already said, and it's interesting, even the dissenting judges agreed that the public square is the public square. They thought that the majority of five, the conservatives who didn't dissent, but they didn't subscribe to this part of the opinion that said that the internet is like the public square of today. Well, I like it that even the conservatives acknowledge that you have to allow free speech and discourse and the right peaceably to assemble and all this to take place in the actual public street. In Louisiana, we've got exclusion zones in the criminal code that actually criminalize being on the street in quite a few places. So at least that. But five members of the court in Packingham said that the internet is the new public square. So yes, there is an argument. They don't immediately, you know, the powers that be don't immediately succumb to rational arguments. They have to be hammered and sued usually. And state legislatures, I find the only way that we can bring them to the table on any issue affecting registrants is to defeat them in a court. And in this state, that would have to be federal.
Josh?
Yeah, you know, I mean, to me, the interesting thing is always has nothing to do with this part of the story, but is that, you know, yes, the internet has become the digital public square or whatever, but most of the places you can gather in the digital public square are actually corporately owned. And to me, that's the interesting thing, because we usually think of free speech in terms of protection from government and intrusion into free speech. But like, for instance, with Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, I mean, a lot of us who listen to this podcast are, you know, excluded by the company that owns Facebook and Instagram from having accounts on Facebook and Instagram. And, you know, there's that's a whole different thing when, you know, there's no protection theoretically against that. And it's one of the real problems with the idea of moving to a digital public square, because you know, it's not the same as an actual public square that's owned by the city or whatever.
Yeah, and that's right. That's an important point that I didn't address at all, that as far as the companies that provide these formats, they are not state actors, so there is no 1983 action that can be brought against them. We should try to win their hearts and minds. There is a little bit of precedent for making privately owned forums have the rights for public square. Airports and malls have been there. There's older precedent saying that those rights apply to those places. It's still a problem of how to make them be state actors. The matter might address itself to legislation and things other than just legal action that you can force somebody to stop doing something. But I think that they have become so pervasive, it is reasonable to look at regulating these four men. This is not the libertarian view, okay? But they are in some respects like public utilities, except with a public utility, it's heavily regulated, but they've kind of got a built-in profit and a captive set of customers. The internet companies, you've got some huge, huge actors that are about unavoidable. They're not necessarily true monopolies, but I think that antitrust legislation, it just doesn't seem to be enforced anymore. But I think if the government were of a mind to get these big providers to fall in line on things like this, they could certainly make it happen. But they have government, for the most part, doesn't want to make these things happen, and so they've got a good excuse not to require private actors like these platforms to lighten up and let more people participate. Now, one of the things that the caller said was without restriction. Now, that's the part that I don't think is ever going to fly. Registrants.
He actually is now doing a follow-up. Could ISPs exclude registrants since they are privately owned? I can't imagine that an ISP would exclude you. Like, they don't care. You pay your $50 a month for your internet, they're going to turn your lights on.
Yeah.
But I do think they could. I mean, just like any private company could.
Oh.
It's a choice. You know, I mean, you could say it's public accommodation, I think, maybe. But I don't know. What do you think, Larry?
Well, it depends on if you believe in that crazy notion of evolving standards of decency. Yeah. If you believe in that liberal mumbo jumbo, you would say yes, that for the founders would never have anticipated such a situation, and of course the Constitution would cover private actors. But if you take by golly, those words, they mean what they say, and they mean no more than what they say. Then clearly, as a constitutional claim, you don't have one. But we can by statute make this a public accommodation. That's how we've got the public accommodations that we have now. The laws, those were put into statute back in the liberal era in the 60s.
It's stretched a little bit out of shape from what it originally was. Public accommodation initially was limited to hotels, motels, and eating places.
But we've actually been going backwards. You know, the people that have argued from the religious side, they've argued that, well, by golly, I shouldn't have to bake no cake for somebody I don't want to, and I don't agree with what they do. And it's my right, my religious freedom. And I ask them, I said, well, okay, I'm in. That's your religious freedom. How are you going to feel when you walk into a Middle Eastern-owned hotel and they say, madam, we do not rent to you because you do not have a male escort? Are you going to defend that person's religious freedom? And they magically do it a complete about face when you pose that question to them. They say, well, this is a Christian country. So,
Larry, you just pissed off half of our listeners. I could just see it.
Why would
I hope you don't have a very big listenership in Dearborn.
Why would that piss anyone off?
The same reason
it was
that
probably the accent, the stereotypical accent.
That's exactly. I did that to illustrate the point. When you go into an establishment that's owned by someone who doesn't look and talk exactly like you, and they have a religious freedom and they express it in their dialect that they speak from, I want to know what your reaction is going to be. That's
the point was a good things, one. Yeah.
Your point was a good one. I think what people would object to was the stereotypical accent, probably.
But that reminds me of that senator from New York who did the Judge Lance Ito imitation instead of Japanese American.
That's the realistic picture of who owns the hotels in this country. I can't help reality, but most roadside hotels, the majority.
You're saying that accent was a realistic accent?
I don't know if it's the accent, but you're very likely to encounter someone from India or somewhere in the Middle East that has a very different view of religious freedom than what you have. And if you are
no one was denying your point was a great point.
if you're all about religious freedom, then you would turn around and you would say, yes, he should be able to say, I won't rent to you. But magically, you would not say that. And that's why your argument is so flawed about religious freedom.
And I think having a storefront is what makes those places more vulnerable. If it was, you know, wedding cakes made in my home by appointment or whatever, you'd probably have a stronger position.
All right. We got to shut it down. We're done. We've killed it all. Josh, as always, you are a great friend, and I truly appreciate you coming on board. And please tell everybody, you're on the Twitter everywhere. You are like 10,000 a day. Do you post? How many times a day on Twitter do you post? It's insane. It's an insane times, number. Though. Stop. It's an insane number. And where can they find you?
My Twitter is at Joshua B. Ho, and my podcast is Decarceration Nation. We just had a new episode with, strangely enough, once we were talking about fake news and CNN, CNN commentator Abdul El Sayed was on this week. So.
Does he speak with an accent like Larry just described?
No, he doesn't.
Okay, just checking.
But he does probably believe in religious freedom, so we're all good there.
And King Alexander, how can people reach out to you? And do you have anything that you would like to plug or share? Any big cases that you're working on that you could even divulge? Anything exciting?
He doesn't want anybody to reach out to him. He's a public defender.
That's probably true.
But I do answer mail. If people send me, they can email me at ekalexander@pdolaw.org.
Very good. And Larry, as always, you are the master, and I greatly appreciate it and enjoy the time we spend. And that's all I got. Thanks, everyone, for joining tonight. Have a great night.
Thank you, too. Thanks, Andy.
Good night.